The following interview was conducted for the Yachting Oral History Project of Mystic Seaport Museum, Incorporated. The narrator is Olin Stevens. The interviewers are Fred Calabretta, George Moffat, and Francis Bowker. The interview took place at Mystic Seaport Museum on February 24th, 1989.
Let's see. I guess just to start, if you could maybe talk a little bit about how Mr. Barham first approached you with the idea of the design, how it came about.
Yes, well, I don't honestly remember the absolute beginning, but I do know that he, from the very beginning, he wanted to have a boat that was the very best thing of its type that could be done, and particularly emphasizing the structural part of it, the materials and the workmanship that went into the whole thing. And of course, there was no doubt in my mind, or I don't believe in his either, that Ben Evans was probably the best qualified yard at the time, and we had it right there from the start. And I think it turned out pretty much the way he wanted it to be.
And since he was launched in 1932, when did he first come to you? Was that in?
I suppose it was in 30. I wouldn't be absolutely sure just when. I think he talked to Drake probably first from a business point of view, because my partner Drake Sparkman took care of all of that part of it in those days. And then Drake told me something about the sort of design that he wanted, which definitely sounded right to me. I think he may have been worried, reminded of it just glancing at the book. He might have been worried that we try to push a racing type of boat too much. But I didn't feel particularly that way. I was interested in racing, all right, but I was also interested in what would make a good cruising boat. And for just about what he wanted at that time, and before that time, being interested in boats, I'd been very much interested in the work that an Englishman named Dick Lloyd Worth was doing. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but he was a very meticulous English doctor whose other occupation was cruising in more or less offshore, and he owned
three boats in Turn.
Yeah, Turn. That's right. Turn. Ultimately, I think there were four, but the one that he described most fully in a book called Yacht Cruising, which I almost knew by heart at the time, was about called Turn 3, and he believed in a fairly heavy type of boat with more area forward than I probably would have given a racing boat, and a long keel and so forth. But I was very happy to go along with what I considered to be his influence at that time, because I admired his work and felt for real seagoing work that what he had done was very sound and sensible and good, mainly good advice to follow. I don't believe he ever saw Brilliant, but if he did, I don't know if he would have approved of it or not. As I interpreted his work, she was very much the sort of quote that he was advocating in his writing.
What was her rig?
Well, yeah, his boats were, both of them, or three or four of them, were rigged as cutters.
As cutters,
The schooner rig was quite different, and actually, I can't say I remember feeling strongly about it. I was happy to have the work to do, but I don't think I personally would have picked the schooner rig. It's worked out very well.
Worked out very well.
did Mr. Barham play an active role, or was he in contact with with you a lot.
Oh, I would say so. He was very thorough and very well. He was in a position to ask for the best, and he wanted to be very sure that he got it. I think he had confidence for both in our office and in the yard that he was, you know, very closely tied up with it as it went along.
Was Craig Sparkman, was he a designer as well?
No, he wasn't. He had a normal interest in design, but he was a good sailor and a good salesman. He didn't pretend to be technically involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you comment a little bit on the way real design details were handled? Did you have to go into a great deal of drawing for that, or was there a sort of verbal understanding that you had with the yard to liaison all those details?
Well, we got to look at the plans. We tried to make a normally complete set of plans, but of course, much later we got involved in Navy work, and we never made would be called working drawings. We made what I consider, I think, were generally considered as good yacht designs, principally consisting of line offsets, of course. And then longitudinal construction plan, the training plan, which I saw reproduced in the book there. And Rod drew quite a detailed sail plan. I think Rod made the drawing of that himself. He didn't do a great deal of drawing work, but he did that one. And it shipped several sections that would show the structure at different points and an interior layout. But I think that the Nevins went into much more detail than we provided on the interior, like the paneling and all of the details of the berths and other interior furniture, so to speak. That I think they did more than we did. Although we made, of course, the layout.
Did they leave a lot of that up to the boss carpenter?
Well, they had a very good. They had a very good loftsman, and they had a very good man on the interior. And they didn't make very many scale drawings, but this interior man laid out a lot of it full size on the floor in the loft of the yard. He did a really great deal of interior work full scale on the floor before he put it into the boat, that was principally the way it was done. Then, of course, Nels Halverson was the loftsman. He was very, very good. I don't know whether you ever knew him or not.
Nels Halverson?
Nels, yes. Nels, N-I-L-S, S-A-L. B-E-R-S-O-N, I think that's the way he spells his name.
So he would have been working directly under then Rufus Murray?
Yes, that's right. And also there was Ernie Akers. Somebody mentioned his name earlier. He was possibly in that photograph, although I didn't recognize him. But he was, Murray was the general manager of the whole outside operation. Akers was a sort of shop foreman for the building work. Halverson, no, I'm giving you his name wrong. His name was Halverson, H-A-L-V-O-R-S-E-N.
Halverson.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I got that wrong, but Halverson is right.
How often did Henry Nevins look in on what was, or how active a part did he take as far as, supervising a little bit or keeping an eye on?
Oh, well, he was the world's greatest salesman by trying to discourage anybody from building a boat. He thought anybody who built a boat must be crazy. It seemed as though he landed these jobs by talking against them as hard as he could, just telling everybody how hard it was, how expensive it was. He would be right down his alley, had them all ready for the worst. I think he watched pretty carefully. I think he was, Murray was a very good man in the yard, but I think it was I think it was Mr. Nevins who you know, sort of kept everything up to the mark. He made sure that things were done right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the boss's job anywhere, I guess.
Then he had another man, I don't know, that he was really involved in, closely with, not closely with Brilliant, but he had a man named John Byrne, must have been an Irishman, who was also played a leading part in the operation under Nevins. I think he was more involved in the business side of it. I don't remember thinking of him as an accountant, but I rather think he may have been treasurer of the firm, and was under Mr. Nevins was closely involved with the business. And he had a very good, he had a very efficient purchasing agent there. I can't think of his name, but he was a very good man. So Nevins had together a first-class group, mm-hmm. you know, and the results showed.
Did George Crush figure into the design of RV construction of Brilliant Ray Hubbard?
I don't remember just how. In fact, I don't remember the exact timing. I worked there in the drafting room a little earlier, and I worked for a short time under Charlie Moore, and then later George Crouch. I think that George may have had a good deal to do with the detailing of that engine foundation and tank, that whole thing.
Apparently there was a Howard Smith also involved in that work that was...
Yeah, I know, I can't remember that name, but I don't exactly place him. He may have been in there. I guess he was an assistant to Crouch. I think he was in the drafting room.
He's also an architect, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
I guess that system is one of a kind.
Yeah. Well, it inherited some of it from Harrisoff, so I don't think, you know, there wasn't anybody as brilliant in design and engineering as that Harrisoff. But, of course, Rufus Murray carried the Harrisoff tradition down to City Island, and Nevins, as I said, insisted on first-class workmanship and materials all the way through.
How involved were you and Rod during the construction?
Well, as we would be with any boats, and possibly more so because it was very close to where we were. Rod, I guess, I think he must have been actually employed at the yard at that time, and as such, he certainly would have been watching it all closely, but I don't think he was assigned to any specific work on that particular boat. He worked at the yard. He trying to think when he started. He left in 33, and he must have gone in there in 30. I think he was there about 3 years, which would have covered the period when Brilliant was built. But I don't know that. I don't think he
13,
had any responsibility for and he was not. I said he drew the sail plan, which I'm sure he did. So he must have left the yard. Gosh, when would that sail plan must have been done in 31, 32? Was it 31, I think. Sorry, but I don't recall too clearly. I thought Rod was there until later, but he came with us and as an S in 33.
I know on the original construction specifications, which you drew up, you referred a number of times in the specifications that further details would come at a later stage with regard to certain aspects. So is that the procedure that certain stages of construction details come in at different times?
I think so. It's probably not at all unusual. I don't think it is even now to have a race between the designer and the builder to get these things done.
Right.
I've often wondered how did Rosenfeld get so involved? He took a great many more pictures than I think he would have.
I can't be certain, but I'm almost certain that Bynum and Walter asked him to do that, to get the whole story of the history of our construction.
Boy, they just did a magnificent job with it.
Yes, but I think he was employed really by
Bynum
to do that.
Uh-huh.
Do you recall anything unusual about the construction materials that were used and or the...
Well, the planking is a little unusual in the sense that it was a heavier material than what I would have chosen for a racing boat. It was much more usual to use mahogany, but teak, of course, has a lot to recommend it if you're not too much worried about weights. It's a great material. Again, frames were big frames for steam bent frames, but that was the construction that Evans liked and which I had gotten to like and approve of anyway. I didn't have the background he had, but I'd watched boats building in his shop regularly for the many years that I had to do that. Whereas I was not at all sold on the Down East type construction with sun frames and that sort of thing.
Well, they're big frames to bend.
They're big frames to bend. So that,
they certainly have proven out.
They have. Mm-hmm. I think Akers, Murray first, but Akers under Murray, they were both responsible for selecting the wood and material that went into the boat and all the Nevins boats, but of course they were under special instructions to be very, very
do the best.
Do the very best that they could on this one. I think the Akers generally went shopping for it over. There was a place in Nanuet, New York, over, I guess over the west side of the Hudson River that they bought a lot of wood. Over there, he picked it out, but he had to satisfy Murray.
Okay. Walter Bynum indicated to me that he had quite a little bit to do with it. He must have been around quite a lot.
I think he
had ideas before he started.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
He was very explicit in his requirements as an owner, as some ownership.
Which we have.
Well, you want to
roll her over and come up with everything intact, possibly minus the sails.
Yeah. That's right. Well, it's still a good formula. I wish that more present-day boats could do that and had to.
Do I dare to ask if he became a nuisance at all to the builders? Or?
Oh, I don't think so. He might have a little bit, but I think that, for one thing, he built this boat right during the bottom of the Depression, and he seemed to have a bottomless pocket, and so it was in Nevin's interest as a builder to see that he was satisfied in every way. I don't think it was under contract except in terms of time and material, not a fixed contract. And so he paid for the time.
Well, it kept the gang together at all, right?
Kept the gang together, that's right. No, and Evans was glad, and certainly I was glad to have the work.
Anybody was glad to have a job in those days.
That's right.
Green was design number 12, as I understand it. And I know you were involved with 6-meter design and of course, the raid. Were the other 11 boats racing machines? Or?
No, not racing machines. There were, as you say, several 6-meters in there and the raid. And there were several boats, three or four boats, built at the Minniford Yard. In fact, we designed about a 37-foot, I think it was about 37 feet, a sloop, single-masted, although I think I started at least with a double-head rigging mast pretty far back in the boat. for H.S. Sayers, who was the owner of the Minniford Yard at the time. He built this boat to our plans. And then he built a sister ship for Bob Moore, who was a very good friend of our family, friend of my father's. And he had two sons about my age and Rod's, and we had sailed together quite a bit. And he bought a sister ship, as I remember. And he built those two boats at Minniford, which we designed. And then it was about that time, I think, preceding Brilliant and the Numbers, we designed a boat for Dave Hannon Morris, called Alcimar, which I think he had some hopes, which I don't remember sharing, that he could get it going as a one design class. It was designed for cruising, but with the Long Island Sound kind of weather in mind. And she was probably, frankly, a little over rigged and her beam, maybe. She was very fast in light weather, but she won some races with her. And she lived quite a long life. I don't know where she is now, but she went a long time. And I think eventually her rig was cut down a bit, and that's probably improved on her. She was around for quite a while and perfectly good boat. So she was one with possibly 3 6-meters and one or two other cruising type boats that fitted in that numerical order.
And stormy weather came along shortly after.
Stormy weather was later, though. She came out in 1934. I don't remember her design number. It might have been 24 or something in the 20s, I think.
White Mist and Revenant.
They were lighter still.
They were
lighter. We had designed several boats that were built. We had a Providence office and then a Boston office, and designed several boats that were built in the Providence-Boston area at about that time. I think it was about the same time as Brilliant. I know it was during the Depression. Rather an interesting contrast to Brilliant, actually, was a motor sailor for a man named Knowles, a textile manufacturer in New Bedford, I know. His family is still active there or not. But she was a bigger boat than Brilliant. She was 72 feet over the law. And he laid down the law. He was very different from Barnum. He said if he could get this boat built in a way that would satisfy him for $20,000, he could.
He satisfied him.
He probably built the boat and satisfied him. And he was perfectly pleased, perfectly happy with the boat.
Don't imagine she's around now.
No, she was built with galvanized spikes to hold the spikes in place. As a matter of fact, she is around now.
That's
in San Francisco. Uh-huh. And she's not. She hasn't done badly at all. I haven't been out now for several years, but last time I was out at the Tinsley Island cruise, which was 4 or 5 years ago, she was there. She's not done badly. But she was a bigger boat than Brilliant. And she was a bigger boat than Brilliant and built for not more than 20% of the cost, I should say. She had a Whitten diesel engine. I always remember this man. It's not maybe very nice to talk about it. But we made a sort of a trial trip from Neponset over to Provincetown, and I was along on the trip. And my wife drove the car to Provincetown to pick me up. And there was an trial engineer from Whitten Engine on the boat. As far as I could see, everything was in good order. And I offered him a ride back from Provincetown to someplace where he could get get a plane. It would have been plane and a train or something. And Knowles wouldn't let him go. He insisted that he should
stay there. But make sure he got home.
Let me just return to Rufus Murray for a minute. I remember Barnum writing that Rufus Murray's work on Brilliant was regarded as his masterpiece, or Brilliant was called the Murray masterpiece. Is that an exaggeration, or is that just something that
perhaps... Well, I think she was a masterpiece of the time at the Yard. Of course, Murray had worked in Bristol, and his work was different in a way, but I wouldn't know that it was the fat of the Harris Austin.
Seemed like a pretty grand title.
After the war, when Briggs bought her, was it his idea to change the rig?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I think so.
At first he had a gaff and still carried the topsail, but it was, as I remember, 9 feet that they...
I think he was sort of fed up with the topsail. I think behind it. I don't remember it too clearly to say just one.
I was sorry that it was changed to Marconi because when you're running off before the wind, the Marconi mainsail is a problem the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you got a gaff to swing out against the rigging there, you feel a little more secure and you get more drive.
I think that the gaff rig suited that boat very well.
And she became a little crank too, with all that extra
loft there. The only criticism I'd make of the book, I think there are a lot of pictures there that show her heeled over further than one was.
But you took a reef on her, and she was pretty good. Is pretty good, I should say.
Well, we went on a trip, you had some pictures there. We identified Rufus Murray down Long Island Sound and then around Shelter Island and Gardiner's Bay. And I do remember that we had, it blew very hard in Gardiner's Bay. I remember that somehow. She behaved well. It was very choppy there. I guess the water's not terribly deep, and it was blowing hard. And she seemed a bit wet to me at the time. That was the only criticism that
she's wet.
She is.
Were you pleased and satisfied, generally?
Oh yeah. Yes. I think she balanced well, and with the gaff rig, I think she was adequately stable and not the tremendous powerhouse. I don't remember that Walter Barnum was in any way dissatisfied, but I don't think she was quite the powerhouse you might look for in that sort of boat. Although she certainly does go well in the breeze, so I don't think it's any real criticism.
He said he'd build her to take a trip around the world, and I never felt that she was really a comfortable enough vessel, so I would want to go around the world with her. Sofong had just enough extra length to have some room down below.
Yes.
A little more beam, and I went aboard her several times. This would be a much more comfortable vessel to sail.
I'm pleased to hear you speak of Sofong, because I always thought she was one of her better designs. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a logical development of Brilliant and as a later boat, something of an improvement in some ways. I was probably more influenced by Worth at that period, and feeling that what Worth advocated was very much what Walter Barnum wanted, and that of course his boats were even shorter forward and deeper in the forefoot than Brilliant. That they must have been pretty wet also. And Sofong has a little bit different forebody shape, which is probably
She's off in Vietnam now, is that right? Or Southeast Asia someplace?
I don't know.
I heard that she was seized over there. I think it was Cambodia.
Cambodia, was it?
Somebody said they took the spars out of her, made her completely engined, and they were using her to transport materials around.
Oh, gosh.
Well, made her into a freighter.
Two nights about for that.
Oh, the idiot that bought her, I think he was one of these do-gooders that went out there to try and stop the war, all that sort of stuff. And they just picked him up, put him in prison, and finally sent him home.
What do you know of Briggs Cunningham's motivations for buying Brilliant? Why would a man who was so much into racing and speed in general with cars and everything else go for a boat like Brilliant?
Well, I don't know exactly, except I know he admired her construction. I think, like other people who are able to afford what they wanted, he had a liking for the best. I think he felt that of her type, particularly in her construction, that she was the best, and that he had the satisfaction of owning her for that reason. I think that was if you can sort of examine. Make a guess about it. It's a psychological.
Mm-hmm. He certainly has been good to her.
Yes. Well, it's true. Very good to her. He evidently felt that way about the boat. He had owned other Nevins built boats, of course, and had an interest in what the yard had turned out.
Mm. I don't comparisons are odious, but you've mentioned that Nevins was recognized as being an excellent yard to build a top quality boat. Dorade was built at Minifords next door shortly before, 2 years before.
Yes.
Can one make comparisons between Minifords and Nevins and Harrisburg?
Well, we would have built boat at Nevins if he could have taken her on, but by that time he was. Well, he was still, I shouldn't have really said by that time, he was still busy. The depression had hit, but it hadn't struck home when the raid was built and Evans Yard was filled up by the time
30.
We got ready to go ahead with her. And so Manfred was the second choice, and they did a good job, but we would have preferred Evans at the time.
Were you having many? I think it was Anya 3 you had built your at Nat Harrisoff.
Yeah, well, that was a good deal later. Harrisoff, even then, I don't think was 33. What it had been, nor do I think they were really very much interested in bidding competitively with other yards. I'm not just sure when the changeover took place, but of course they had built primarily, if not exclusively, Harrisoff designs, and then they retired and sold the yard to Happenrapper, and he took in other designs, but I think that was a little bit later. Mm-hmm. They did build for 1930. They built two of the cup contenders, William Owen Enterprise and Lollipop, Yankee and Whirl. Lolly was active still, and it did a certain amount of work for us, and they were very confident, but they didn't have quite the feeling for perfect sort of structure and material and all that Nevins had. As I say, they built this big motor sailor for a fraction of Brilliant's price, and she is still going.
She's been refastened.
Yeah.
I heard a story that at the Nevins yard during those Depression years, there were so many skilled, very able people out of work that there was actually a row of men sitting on a bench outside the works waiting for work, and that it was apparently the Nevins policy that if a person made a mistake in their labor, they would be given till the next day to correct it on their own time, and if they couldn't correct it, that they would be Actually, that sounds severe to me, but is there
I
any...
think it is. I think that's somebody imagined that.
Somebody imagined that.
I think. I can't say for sure.
They might have done it to somebody.
Yeah.
They wanted to get rid of somebody. Maybe.
That's true.
It sounded brutal to me. But, well,
I think these sometimes the things do happen just once, and then somebody else gets a hold of the story, and it becomes a habit. It
becomes a story and a legend.
Yeah, I think it is really dark.
It sounds brutal. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just that way. Of course, this chap I mentioned, John Byrne, the Irishman who was sort of a lieutenant to Evans, he was a hard-boiled fella. He was tough, and people knew that. But I don't think it was quite
a tough way. Well, it's a story told to me, and I'm glad to have it refuted.
It tarnished the image of a kindly looking yard to me.
No, but Nat Nevins, I'm not kidding about just being a super salesman by using exactly the opposite tactics of what most salesmen would use.
Well, I suppose when times were good, that was all right. Maybe he didn't want some of those jobs.
Well, he got, except in like two or three very bad years, he had all he could handle.
Did it require any special diplomacy on your part to sort of maintain good relations with Minifords and Nevins, or what sort of thing?
It wasn't particularly, I don't think so. I think that Minifords sort of accepted their position as a little bit secondary to Nevins and somewhat less expensive, competitive, and in a price sense,
they might be a little more in Lawley's character.
But again, different. They all have their own personality. But the Minifords Yard was essentially a real estate operation. The owner, Henry Sayers, owned land on City Island, and he owned land in the East Bronx. He owned Castle Hill swimming pool. I don't know if it's still there or not. Probably not, but it was a busy place at the time. He owned apartment house in the Bronx, and he happened to own the Minifords Yard, and he had his brother, who was not very good, really, running the yard. But I will say for the brother, he was cooperative, and he let us go in there, Rod in particular, who was very much interested in construction, and he had a foreman, an Englishman, George, I don't remember his last name, but he was a capable boat builder. He didn't have the standards that he would have had to work in Evans, but he knew the business, and it worked, and people got their money short. But when there was a 6 meter or a brilliant to be built by it, and Evans was there.
Now, Nevins never got into the big steam yacht business.
No.
How large a vessel would they have built? 30, I think 30? I saw a plan of about 75 or 80 footer.
Oh, yes, he did bigger than that. He had a good friend from Wall Street area, Townsend Irwin, who owned a couple of 6 meters, I think, and who was a member of the New York Yacht Club Race Committee. They built quite a big motorboat called Tara. I think she was about as big as he felt he could build decently out of wood, close to around 100 feet long, I think, something like that. Maybe a little more than that, but not a whole lot.
This is kind of a detailed question, but it hasn't become clear to me. Did Nevins do their own casting as well as machining, or did they send their patterns out to be cast?
I think they sent the patterns out. I don't think they did.
But then they did all their own polishing and machining, I think, didn't they?
Yes.
And pattern making, I think they did all that.
Yes, they did that, I'm sure.
I wonder what happened to all those patterns.
I don't know. I'm afraid a lot of bad things happened during the war. I imagine a lot of nice things were thrown out to make room for other activities and other types of patterns.
Wasn't there a fire in the, was it 50s? I'd heard taking quite a few of those, took a lot of patterns out.
Well, the yard had two rather unfortunate owners after Nevins died. The yard was sold. And I bet or not, I don't remember the name of the first man either, except he was an operator of sorts. And I remember very well his joking about how he could get through the toll booths on the Hudson River Parkway without paying toll.
He was an operator.
Then it got into the hands of the beginning of the war. A man named Whiting, who was also involved with lollies. Whiting was an operator, but a different sort. He didn't, frankly, think too much of him until it came time to build Columbia, which was built a bit later. And I was very hesitant to see him build a boat, but it seemed in the end the best place because he still had acres there and a few good men. What I can say is favorable. He just left the thing there for us, Rod and Wyland and myself, to manage, and Acres. And he left the people who knew what was going on. He left them alone, let them build a perfectly good boat, but he didn't have any idea himself of quality. And I don't know, the yard eventually, soon after that, went bankrupt. And it, in fact, because he failed to pay a bill for heating oil, the yard got very cold one night, and the epoxy glue and some of the frames didn't cure. And the Lloyds made us put screws into all those hold them together.
Was that Columbia?
That's Columbia. Yeah. Yes.
Side two of the original recording begins here.
42.
So I always appreciated Whiting for not interfering with that one job, which was very important to us. But he didn't run a good yard.
What do you remember about Brilliant's launching and trials?
Not too much, except I do remember this trial trip we took, which was involved about 3-day cruise, I guess, down Long Island Sound and around some of the water in the eastern end of the Sound, Gardiner's Bay and Greenport, Sheller Island.
Were both you and Rod?
Yes, we were both aboard.
Was somebody from Ratsey's aboard?
I don't believe there was. I don't remember anybody from Ratsey's being aboard. I was reminded by the photographs, but I remember Murray being on board.
Mm. That was when Fred Bradley was doing the photographing, I think.
Yes, that's right.
We have some photographs of that trial.
Yes.
I wrote to him when I first came here, the same as I wrote to you, trying to get information.
Mm.
And he just wrapped up his albums and sent them up to me.
That was Fred.
He was certainly generous.
Yes. He was a professional photographer, but his professional side of his work was, I guess, in fashions and that sort of thing. And anything he did on the water, he considered was strictly amateur, and he never wanted to get any kind of pay for any of his sailing photographs.
They told me that when they made that first trip, he was the oldest one aboard.
And I suppose he was.
And he was the last one to go.
I was sorry not to know that. I had had an exchange of letters with him, which I had thought was more recent than 3 years, but I guess it couldn't have been. I'm not doing it now. I don't mean to make anything of it, except there was a period of years when I tried very hard to be a painter, strictly an amateur, but did a certain amount of painting, and Fred and I used to go out together now and then to paint, maybe on a Sunday.
Landscape?
Sunday paint is good.
Oh, that's nice.
I think my sister-in-law still has a painting of the silver ball that I did with Fred.
Is oil or watercolor?
The years you spend on the water and around the water, you meet an awful lot of people that are pretty decent sort.
Yes, certainly.
You don't always keep in touch with them, but
all set.
End of original recording.